Talking Heads from the Chartered Institute of Internal Auditors.
Hello, my name is Liz Sandwith and I am the Institute's Chief Professional Practice Advisor. And with me this afternoon, I'm very delighted to welcome Greg Warland, who is the Chief Internal Auditor of Barclays Execution Services. Gosh, Greg, that sounds a very glamorous title. Perhaps you could start by telling us what that involves.
Certainly. Well, first, Liz, let me say thanks. It's my privilege to be with you this afternoon. In a nutshell, it's a much more glorified title than probably what it merits. Essentially, I am the head of audit for Barclays Operations and Technology, and most of Operations and Technology is actually housed in Barclays Execution Services, which is an entity within the Barclays family. So that's the gist of my role.
Thank you for that. Perhaps you could start by telling us a little bit about yourself, and particularly how you got into the technology side of internal audit, because I know our members often struggle to recruit IT auditors, so it will be interesting to hear how you got into the profession.
Certainly. Well, I've been a career internal auditor for almost the last 20 years now. The vast majority of that was actually not technology focused. My background was really more financial crime, fraud and money laundering in particular. And over the years, I think the interplays and the connectivity between some of the fraud elements and cybersecurity and things like that started to pique my curiosity. In more recent times, I was the Chief Internal Auditor for Barclays Africa. And as part of that role, obviously, I oversaw the entirety of the whole of the Barclays Africa function, including technology, and sat on various executive committees for technology. And again, over the years, I think started to read more about technology and try to get better understanding. I returned to the UK about 2 years ago and stepped into this role and have been loving it. Absolutely, absolutely brilliant. I think one of the misnomers is that technology is something that, that general people just don't understand and can't do. And actually, I think that's not the case at all. I think auditors just need to learn the language and need to get a better understanding of whatever it is, be it technology, financial crime, retail banking, whatever it might be. So that's how I got into it.
So do you think then that perhaps the listeners to this, maybe our heads of internal audit, are looking at it from the wrong perspective? If they're looking for a pure IT auditor, should they be looking for other skills?
It depends. I think sometimes it depends on the scale of the organization. So certainly if I use Barclays as an example, there are certainly some specialist skills which we absolutely need. And those could be very deep cyber skills or deep infrastructure type skills and coding capabilities and things like that. On the other hand, I think there are maybe organizations of a smaller scale where more general skills in computer knowledge and IT technology would absolutely be beneficial. So I do think it sort of depends on the scale and size and complexity of the organization. And as a result of that, the focus should be on who to recruit and what. You look at things like the ISAC accreditations and those kinds of things, and I think those are individuals who absolutely have a very good grounding in the fundamentals of what technology is all about. And, that's always a good starting point, I think.
Okay. So when we talk about information technology, IT audit, maybe it would help to start with a bit of a definition. So in that space, do we include cyber? Do we include processing of transactions? What do we include in the definition?
I guess the broadest categories that I tend to think of pure technology on are infrastructure technology and then application technology. Then, of course, it breaks down along various addition elements. So things like, for example, in Barclays, included under the bigger umbrella of technology, I would say, data management, information risk, obviously come into those things. Definitely cyber we would include in the broader sort of spectrum, although you could argue that really cyber sits under security. But it's the interplay which I think is really the, you know, the interesting thing. So a good example might be we can do a number of things by setting up perimeters and having standards and protocols for cyber risk and ensuring that there are appropriate controls in place. But they simply can't work if we don't have the appropriate technology on which they are built and the platforms and all of the rest of it. So I think they're interconnected and actually inextricably linked. But to summarize again, I would say in the broadest spectrum of what I think of as technology, I include cyber, I include data management and architecture, I include all of infrastructure and application technology, I include information risk, I include resilience. So all of those components, I think, all sort of come together.
It's interesting that you use the word resilience, because I've been talking to colleagues and know a number of people have moved away from the language of business continuity and moved into the term business resilience now, which moves it out of our IT colleagues area and across the whole of the organisation, because it prepares you for a cyber attack. It prepares you for a reputational issue. It prepares you for anything. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I think that's exactly the right way to look at it. We've seen that, obviously, working for Barclays and the banking industry, the regulators have been very focused on ensuring that, I think the term is operational resilience, and that includes all manner of ill. And I think that's exactly the way to look at it, because if we don't look at it holistically, we, as you say rightly, we run the risk of fixing a certain sliver of things and actually not really getting the totality of the estate working appropriately. So I think that is a critical component. And operations is a fundamental component to that cog as well, which is why I think structurally the areas that I oversee are both operations and technology in the broadest sense of the term.
So if we take what the regulators say and call it operational resilience rather than business resilience, where does it sit in an organisation?
I think in various areas, typically, again, when I look at large banks and institutions of our size, we typically have it in what we call the chief operating office. So, but I know that it does vary, you know, depending on the way you look at it. But for us, the chief operating office is really where both the operations and technology aspects reside. I mean, interestingly enough, that's purely the back office operation elements, but there are also front office operation elements, which would sit more naturally in what we would call the front office business, you know, sort of business facing roles. And it's again those connections that are just as vital as what's going on, you know, behind the scenes.
So do you then have a strong relationship with your chief operating officer?
Absolutely, yes. Naturally, as an auditor, I have to have a professional skepticism and a healthy skepticism and the like. But at the same time, I am part of the third line of defense. And that third line of defense is working for the same institution, and hopefully we all want to see the same things for the bank. And certainly I know, you know, in my personal situation, that is exactly what it's about. I, in fact, had a call just a couple of hours ago with the chief operating officer, and I'm in close and continuous contact with that individual to ensure that the first line are well set up and doing the things that they believe they should be doing. I'm a big believer from an internal audit perspective that we can't just be a silent bystander. Certainly we can't implement controls. That goes without say. But if we are to see something that seems to be going awry in the first or the second line, we should call it immediately and not have them go and build things that otherwise wouldn't work. And I think that's a very important aspect. So to your question, absolutely fundamental to have a very strong relationship, not just with the chief operating officer, but also the chief information officer, the chief technology officer, the heads of data and of cyber, because all of those people who, at least in our organization, report into the chief operating officer, they all have integral and fundamental roles to play in the success of the institution.
Yeah, that's interesting in terms of what you were saying about the various different pockets within the organisation and the various different departments and how they fit together.
Yeah.
In smaller organisations, you wouldn't necessarily have that infrastructure, and you might still have a director of IT or and maybe not even a chief operating officer. So I guess the relationship will be the same from a head of audit's perspective. They would still build that relationship with their director of IT, who might also be responsible for cyber, you know, things that data management, all of the things that you mentioned earlier.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it cuts across any role, really, whichever scale of the organization, complexity of the organization. Naturally, as the scale of the organization is larger, the level of input and influence that I would necessarily, or anybody in a chief internal auditor role might be able to exert might be a little bit less, because you just can't, your span of influence would be less. But absolutely, for all of those risk disciplines, I think it is critical that the internal auditors are standing pretty close by and listening closely and intently and having good, healthy debates and constructive dialogues as to, you know, the direction of travel for the firm, and understanding exactly how we can ensure that the risks are appropriately mitigated with the appropriate controls.
Well, that's great. Thank you for sharing that. If we just for a moment perhaps scale it down, and you will forgive me, I hope, because I'm going to reduce your very glamorous title to perhaps something a little more mundane. But, you know, I know that you have a group, Chief Internal Auditor Sally Clark,
yes.
And I guess you report into Sally. So if we were to scale it down to smaller organisations, because an awful lot of our members are part of organisations where the internal audit team might be 10, 15 people maximum.
Yes.
So you would have a head of internal audit, chief audit exec, whatever, and then you would have a sort of management tier. So you might be a senior manager responsible for IT. Would that sort of reflect, in if we scale down, how your role plays out here?
Probably, yes. You know, to answer your question, yes. In terms of the scale of our organisation, Sally sits atop of that tree, and she has an executive sort of management team of about 6 or 7. I'm one of those 6 or 7, and my designation is, you know, in roles and responsibilities is over the IT and operations segment of that. It's global in nature, but yeah, certainly if you scale down the organisation, you would absolutely probably have, I would imagine, if you had a chief internal auditor of over a group of 10 or 15, I would absolutely expect that the head of IT would have probably a direct reporting line into that head of audit for that particular function. And I think that's very important, because the scale and the pace of change, particularly I think as we live in this ever-changing and ever-dynamic world, is so much tied to technology and technology aspects. And, of course, we spoke earlier about, I gave the example of cyber and its inextricable links to technology. And the fact is, most of the things that we do in today's society, business-wise and other, are inextricably linked to technology. So the fundamental foundations and the functional aspects absolutely have their technological components. So if we ultimately want to be able to opine on the control environment and the like, we must be able to ensure that we have a good understanding of what that technological infrastructure is all about and how the business processes sit alongside or atop, in some instances, those technology aspects.
That's really helpful in terms of helping us appreciate that. So in terms of scale, just approximate, but I believe that Barclays' internal audit function is around the 600, 650 scale. How many of that 650 sit in your world?
So the estimate, I mean, roughly, is about 185.
Gosh, that's,
yeah,
that's
so
a large number.
It's a lot, yes. I mean, by way of example, I typically tend to think, and of course different organizations may have a slightly different model, but I typically tend to think that if you look at operations and technology as a combined unit, you typically would be saying that one in every three-ish auditors should probably have that sort of bent and that leaning. And again, depending on the size and complexity of the organization, that might vary. It could be slightly up, it it might be slightly lower. But that tends to have been, when we've looked at the organization, we've tended to look at, you know, how are we best placed to be able to ensure that we're going to opine appropriately. And as I say, it's just becoming more and more a fundamental part of the organization is to ensure that we do have technological aspects covered, because they're just becoming so fundamental and so integral. I mean, you might recall, certainly from my earlier days, you know, when I started, laptops weren't even really being used. You know, it was the good old carrying big briefcases filled with binders. And those days are gone. And obviously things move rapidly in terms of how we're scaling. And as a result of that, I think we've got to make sure that we have adequate technology coverage, you know, to ensure that we're opining on the right sort of level.
I think that's a really valid point. And, you know, I smile because I can remember back to the days of briefcases and the quality of the audit being assessed on how many lever arch files you filled.
the girth test, right?
Yes. Yes. And it was amusing. But while we were setting this up, you were saying, you know, showing me your mobile phone and saying, you know, the capacity there is more than was needed to put the man on the moon. And the comprehension of just understanding that is really quite challenging.
Yeah.
I think for all of us in today's world, the pace of innovation is really quite terrifying at times, isn't it? And
absolutely.
Internal audit has to be across all of that. Because our board, our audit committee members who may not be, you know, technology experts are going to look to internal audit to provide some sort of assurance. So if we don't have, and I'm going to use the word luxury, of Barclays with the resources that you have, although I accept you have a huge organisation to audit, are there some tips that you could share with us? Because my nervousness is that we provide a false assurance because we don't have the skill set, or a silent assurance so everyone at the audit committee and board think everything's okay because we're not saying anything. Mm. What ought an organisation that has, I don't know, maybe 15 internal auditors, but not the luxury of one in three having the technical skills, what could they do? How could they provide a level of assurance to their board and audit committee?
So that's a really important question. I'm glad you asked it. I think, let me split it in a few different ways. I think the one thing is no substitute for reading and learning and continuous learning. And I think I mentioned ISAC, and there are other, you know, accreditations out there, but I think it is very important that even when we look at our general population auditors, and I say general, I mean the whole of the population of auditors, even if they are not specifically technology focused, I think it is important to get individuals who may be more business focused to have a level and a degree of technology baseline sort of knowledge. And that's something that I think is very, very important. It's something that we're working on. I think all organizations, regardless of size and scale, should really think about. The second thing is, I think, to look at the kinds of third-party service providers that the organization has, and what level of assurance can we gain from the work that they do, because we might not have the, you know, necessarily the resources. So in this regard, I'm thinking of the old, and again, I'm going to date myself here with the old SAS 70, Statement of Audit SAS 70, and obviously these, you know, they've all changed now in ISO, whatever the number is. And there are various ones for information risk and for different things. But there are levels and degrees of assurance that we can hopefully glean and gain comfort from, and hopefully that can also assist our boards and our executive committees. The third thing I would highlight is a very simple sort of concept, but it is thinking about prioritizing the crown jewels and focusing on what might be really critical, and understanding that, and then thinking about the activities that you might perform and be able to perform, because hopefully you've got some skills in the team to actually look at some of those components. I would also say, kind of touching on the first point again, there are a number of free, if you could imagine, publications out there. And these are white papers and the like. And again, I think knowledge is an incredible thing. And even without a whole lot of resource. We can upskill and get to a level where, if we combine that with the previous point I raised, which is what are the crown jewels and what are those priorities, we can get to a level of saying, you know what, we think actually these are the critical things which we need to be able to cover. It's interesting, I was attending a conference just recently, and they were talking about cyber and some of the cyber risks. And we hear these horrendous things about government intervention and all the, you know, the like. And to be honest, these are quite scary thoughts. But the honest truth is the vast majority of the types of cyber and security attacks that most organizations face are down to some very basic core principles of mail spam, you know, so malicious emails and clicking on things that people shouldn't be clicking on. So it's all great to have the bells and whistles, but that said, if we trained our people and we had the awareness and the knowledge of not clicking on links and attachments and various sorts of things and good policies and procedures, we can actually do a raft of good. And so I think we shouldn't lose sight of that, even in an ever complex and more changing world.
And I think that's a really good point, because I was talking to someone the other day about a phishing spam email that they'd received that purported to come from their CEO. One of these, you know, I need you to send me 30,000 immediately. And they didn't take any action. They didn't click on it. And when we were talking about it, when I asked them why, and they said, because our chief exec never says thank you, and the email had a thank you in it. So,
Very good.
It's not necessarily technical. It's just thinking and knowing your senior people, knowing and understanding your organisation, because some of the things will be as apparent as that if you just take a moment.
Yeah, I suppose there's no substitute for common sense, right?
Absolutely.
And also, you know, if it does seem too good to be true, it absolutely is. So I think you're right on that. But also, I do think that there is just that basic level of understanding of the world that we're operating in. And, you know, I come from a background where I mentioned, you know, I had a big financial crime background and looking at preventative methods, and particularly in the fraud space. And a lot of that stuff has to do with just thinking things through and using common sense approaches. And the likes of malicious phishing and smishing and all of the rest of the ishings that you can get, types of activity, can absolutely be prevented if we just don't click on the links. Mm. But that takes some level of knowledge and, as you say, some common sense, but also policies and structures to say, you know, we will never ask you to divulge your PIN. But you have to keep that in front of people's minds. I think where the risks come in, and the risks are exacerbated when that drops off.
Yes.
And it's not front of mind, and people get complacent. And that's where the bad doers can do some damage. But I completely agree. I think the big point for me is all of the big activities that are mentioned and the incredible power that a state might have in state actors in doing certain things, very oftentimes these are not the issues. And they certainly wouldn't be the issues, certainly for some smaller entities usually.
Of course not.
So it's the basic stuff that we need to get right. And you don't certainly need to be a brilliant cyber genius to be able to run those kinds of shops and mitigate those risks.
Do you have any views about programs such as guest auditors, which might help the internal audit function build its knowledge, be it in the IT space or just general business knowledge?
Absolutely. It's very interesting. I was talking at the Aspire event last night and mentioned guest auditors, and that's something that we see as fundamental. I think it's absolutely critical both ways, actually.
Of course.
So I think our internal auditors going out into the business and really getting a better understanding of what the first line or the second line have to encounter from a commercial sense of the world. And then likewise, bringing in people from the first and the second line and getting great risk exposure and great control exposure, which they don't always necessarily have. And what that does is I think it creates a much healthier culture, control culture throughout the organization, because you are spreading that knowledge. So I think guest auditors are absolutely critical. I think grad programs and schemes are vital in energizing and enthusing the population and making sure that we get the right types of skills in. And again, not only because I think a lot of the grad programs do tend to have a different generation, a different way of thinking and tackling different problems. And I think that's exciting. And that's part of the, I think, part of the excitement of, you know, being in an organization where you have different generations and different backgrounds and cultures and genders and all sorts of things put into the mix and coming up with the best solution. Mm. So that's the excitement of it.
I think that's a really good point, and I'm really excited about the new apprenticeship schemes. And I know Barclays is a really key player in those, because I think that will perhaps give organizations, you know, perhaps the smaller organizations with perhaps a more stringent budget and cost constraints, the opportunity to bring people into internal audit from within the business who don't have the internal audit skills. So if you have a small team, you almost have to recruit people who can hit the ground running because you don't have the luxury of carrying people. Whereas with the apprenticeship schemes, you will get some degree of funding and cover for training. So you can bring in that variety, that diversity that you were just talking about.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think the key there is a bit of a mind shift in terms of thinking about it in a different way. Mm. And again, I've spoken last night at the Aspire event about Agile and how we're trying to audit in it's using different methodologies and being more nimble and efficient. But one of the key successes, I think, of Agile is exactly in the name. It's being agile, being nimble and being fluid and adapting to circumstance. And that's one of the great ways to adapt to circumstance is to find a niche and say, well, you know, we may not have X budget or X resource and we're never perhaps going to have that. But there are other ways that we can solve these problems. And absolutely, I think grad schemes and the like, you know, and apprentice schemes are incredible ways of doing that and refreshing that knowledge base. And then, you know, the term I used to use in Africa is I think internal audit can be and should be an incubator for the business. It should generate individuals who have a level of knowledge and expertise in risk and control that can then go out into the business. And of course, not all, some of us want to be career auditors, but there will be another chunk who actually want to try different experiences. And what better way of strengthening the organization than by turning people into the organization from a risk and control background and understanding that risk and control background? I think that's fantastic for any organization.
I think also that if you adopt that approach, it also gives the people in your incubator the opportunity to have a more holistic view of the organization. You know, if they get pocketed, they will learn about particular areas of the business, but there's nowhere like internal audit to look holistically across an organization.
Yeah.
And therefore they will learn perhaps more than they give back to internal audit if they did a period of time. And I know some organizations put their management trainees through internal audit. You know, there's lots of positive messages there.
Absolutely. There are some organizations that I'm aware of that, for example, if you were to go to, these are large organizations, but I don't see why they couldn't adopt it to smaller organizations as well, where they will not promote to, for example, managing director level. If you are in the first line or in the second line, they wouldn't promote to managing director unless you have spent time in a controls type function. Now, it could be internal audit or it could be some other risk and control function. And likewise for internal audit, they won't promote from within internal audit to a managing director unless you have gone and spent time in one of the other lines. And I think that's critical. I think it's absolutely amazing to be able to do that because it gives the people who are aspiring to certain roles a real clarity of focus in saying, we expect this of you. One of the things I think is always a trick in organizations that I've worked with in the past is making sure that individuals, particularly in the front line, do understand that they have a duty of care and a responsibility over risk and control and not just making money, you know, and sales. And I think, you know, the example that I've just given drives that home very emphatically to say this is part of your core and what we believe you have to be. So very, very important, yeah.
Okay. So thank you for that, Greg. And as we're coming towards the end of our session, and thank you very much for your time, can I ask you then, when can we expect to see Greg Warland as CEO of Barclays?
Oh, that's a lightning bolt out of the blue. No, let me just say, it's been a privilege spending time with you. I think, again, this is an incredibly important topic, and I know it's been focused on IT. We've touched on the things a little bit more broadly, but, you know, in summation, I think one thing to take away is technology. Yes, there are deep pockets and specializations, but having said that, people shouldn't be afraid of technology and they shouldn't be scared off getting involved in technology. We sort of started off with that question, and I'm talking very heavily here to some of the women out there. It's very difficult sometimes to recruit into technology roles, not because women aren't capable, they're absolutely more than capable, but it's actually the fact that we don't have many women who are coming through the grad schemes and studying technology for some reason. And we've got to do a better job at that, because I want diversity of thought, I want diversity of leadership, and that means we've got to get all genders and, you know, blends of everyone getting involved. So I think that's a really critical component to it. But the other thing is, I think broadly, think creatively. It really doesn't matter about the scale of the shop that you have. The problems can be solved. We've provided some, hopefully, some helpful solutions in terms of grad schemes, apprentice schemes, guest auditor programs, white papers we can leverage off of, the old type SAS 70s where we can get assurance from our third-party providers. And that way, I think we can have a much better view of how we're covering technology risk. And, you know, again, it is integral. It's only going to become more important as we go into the future. But thanks very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you very much indeed, Greg. Grateful for your time.
Thank you for downloading Talking Heads from the Chartered Institute of Internal Auditors.